This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
The Podcast Studios is the home of the Head Stuff Podcast Network. It's where lots of our shows are recorded, and we work on editing, promotion, videos, live shows, and lots more. As a podcast production company with three state-of-the-art studios for audio and video in Dublin City Centre, we can work with you to tell great stories in a professional and engaging way. From government organisations to charities, arts groups to international brands, entrepreneurs to hobbyists, we've worked with everybody and we can help you to get the word out. Whether you need studio time, you're hosting a live stream or webinar, or you need support with editing or marketing, we can tailor a package for you. For more info, head to thepodcaststudios.ie.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of F&I Rap Chat. Today we have Ronica Merle on as our guest. I'm delighted to be welcoming her onto the show. If you don't know Ronica already, she is an award-winning screenwriter. She also directs and she runs the Wicklow Stories Film Festival. She's very prolific. She's written more than 22 feature-length scripts at this point, and now she's also in development for a funded feature film called The Closing, which she has written and will also be directing. She's also written two books. So she has a collection of prose, poetry and letters called I Love You, Dave Taylor. And she also has a book also available on Amazon called The Hustle, which is about screenwriting and the process there. So with that, I'd like to welcome Ronica onto the show. The conversation that we have is, we cover a lot of topics. There are some light trigger warning for around 15-20 minutes in, because there's some topics there around abuse and such. But I think it's a really important and very interesting episode, and we cover a lot that would be very helpful for anyone that is looking to get their scripts, both their scripts finished, but also their scripts made into films. Because Ronica's worked very hard over the last couple of years, and it's really been paying off. So with that, we'll go to the episode. So, Ronica, thanks for joining me on the show. So, what are you up to at the moment?
At the moment, I'm in pre-production for three projects. The closest is, time-wise, is the next installment of the Wicklow Stories Anthology, which is the flagship film for this year's film festival, the Wicklow Stories Film Festival, which I run. The next project is a short film in London, that I'm flying over to shoot in April. And then the big project for this year is my feature film, The Closing, which is going into production in the summer. So I'm working in pre-production on these three projects, and it's a lot of work.
I can believe it, because you sort of work between a lot of different fields and areas. So I know your main thing is as a writer, but you're also now producing, you're also directing, and I imagine there's quite a lot in between there, because, you know, as it is when you're sort of doing some of the more low budget productions and working the way through things, there is a lot that we all end up having to do to get projects through.
Exactly. And I should have mentioned at the top as well, I obviously co-own a screenwriting agency as well, so that's also a lot of work. I enjoy the various aspects of filmmaking. I enjoy producing, I enjoy directing, but my core is always a writer. I'm a writer by trade, I always say. And directing is something that just helps bring the vision that I wrote down to life. And it gives me the privilege of working with actors and with crew to bring a little bit more magic into what I wrote down. But story and writing is always going to be the main thing that I'm focusing on.
Yeah, well, it's always good to keep that as the focus. So what was it that brought you into writing, and even more specifically, like film?
Well, there was two steps. I'd always been a writer, so writing was always something. It's just who I am. But film specifically, there were two things that made me decide, oh no, I have no other choice. I don't have a choice. I have to do this. This is the only way my life is ever going to be fulfilled. The first, which I think is for many people of our generation, would have been The Lord of the Rings. Specifically the endless hours of behind the scenes footage that you got with the box sets. And I would just sit there and watch them build like chainmail and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, so that's what filmmaking is. Now I get it. And that kind of lay dormant for a long time. And then I came to Ireland and I was not involved in film at all. I wrote a play. My first thing that was ever commissioned, I wrote a play when I was 13, that was performed when I was 14. And that was a commissioned piece. And that was the only thing I'd ever done with regards to the performing arts. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, that's the thing that I did. But it doesn't, this is just the thing. And then in 2015, shortly after the birth of my first child, I watched a film called The Last Days in the Desert. And it's this obscure little film with Ewan McGregor, where Ewan McGregor plays Jesus. It's really obscure. It is the most obscure thing, and nobody's seen it, and I don't think you can even find it anywhere anymore because the distribution never really happened. And I watched it and I was just completely transformed, and I realized, oh my God, this is what you can do. This is what you can do with good writing. This is what it takes. And it was in that moment when the credits rolled on that film, I knew that I had to be a screenwriter, that all the writing I was doing, which was like, you know, essays and short stories and the novel that I was working on that I never really quite was, you know, determined enough to finish. I was like, this is it. This is it. This is what I need to do. But it took me another 3 years to actually make the jump and to actually go into screenwriting. And I did a 6-week course at Flying Turtle Productions, which I can highly recommend, with Barry McAvoy. He's amazing. It was like a 6-week course and I didn't do much. And then in the winter, I wrote The Indian Wife, which was my third ever script. And looking back on it now, it's probably not really good by my standards today, but I was very lucky to get into the finals at the Oscars with that script. So I was a finalist at the Nicol Fellowship with that script, and from then on, that led to me establishing myself as a reliable writer who can. You know, produce a script quite quickly or give notes quite quickly or be thorough, I suppose, in my approach to writing. And then it kind of snowballed. And then I was able, during the pandemic, I wrote a lot. And then I was able to leverage the successes that I'd had in the past to lead to new connections. I made some connections in the UK. I started working very closely with a director in Canada whom I still haven't worked with, But we keep talking to each other and we're like, we should work together. And we're like, yeah, we should. And it's been 3 years and we still haven't. And then I started making all these connections abroad, connections here in Ireland. And through those, I caught the attention of people who then wanted to work with me. And now here I am, working with people. And that's the breakdown of the history.
Very good. And I know, you know, we make the work that we do, but then there's also the challenge of promoting it and making sure that our names actually get out and everything. And I know that's something that you do treat as something, you know, a major part of the work as well. And I imagine that's something that you were doing a good bit when you had work to present. And
yeah.
Talk a bit about that.
Self-promotion is so, so unfamiliar, I think, to the Irish psyche. Because, oh, jeez, the notions now on you. don't be having notions there now. Working a lot with Americans, that does not exist in the rest of the world. That sense of, oh, now, jeez, now, don't be thinking of yourself as something great. Think of yourself as something great. You are great. You're amazing. Everybody's amazing. And we should celebrate that. And the loudness. And I am well aware that I am very loud. I am annoyingly so. My stupid face. I'm sure people get sick of seeing it or reading my name or whatever. Not to say that I don't care, but I don't care. It's how I make a living. I think the understanding that self-promotion is not a dirty thing. Now you can make it I suppose an annoying thing, but if you're genuine about it, I don't think it should be considered a problem. But yeah, our world doesn't end at, you know, the beach. There is a world beyond, and we're so lucky. We are so uniquely privileged here in Ireland that Hollywood already loves us. The Oscar nominations came out today, and it's like, it's just banshees everywhere. So, you know, we are uniquely lucky in that we don't have a language barrier. Our accent is pleasing to the ear for everyone. We have the reputation of being lovable, and we have the reputation of being the land of storytellers anyway. And we should be leveraging that more. And that's kind of the point. That was also the point why Gavin Ryan and myself founded Acura, the screenwriting agency, because we were like, we are the land of storytellers, and yet it's never Irish stories, unless you're, you know, McDonagh. It's never Irish stories that get told. When we have such a rich and interesting storytelling culture here. So to come back to the point of self-promotion, promoting yourself internationally is something I find very, very easy, but I know that, because I get approached about it a lot, I know that a lot of people don't really know where to start, what to do, how to do these things. So what I can recommend is you know, the internet is a lovely place, F&I being a great example of that, to network and to find new connections. But we needn't stop, especially as writers. Now, if you're a director, you kind of have to be on set. It's kind of a little bit important. As an actor, you kind of have to be there physically. But as a composer, as a writer, as even for, you know, colorist, anything that kind of has to do with post-production, you don't necessarily need to be there. You can do it online, you can do it remotely. Especially as a writer, you don't need to be there at all. And that's a privilege, and we should be utilizing that more. Promoting yourself internationally and being a little bit noisy and getting rid of the idea that notions, I think is very important.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I think it's it is a very cultural thing that we have where we're, I guess, yeah, if you're going to try and draw attention to yourself, you better have a very good reason for it.
Exactly.
Might be one way that it could be seen, but that does kind of fly in the face of being within the entertainment industry where it is all about attention and actually drawing people's eyes to the things that you're doing.
Show business. We should show off more. Now I get it. If you don't have anything to show for, but most people, I guarantee you, most people listening to this right now have something to show for. We don't need to be, you know, perfect in order to already carve out our path. I'd argue it's a good thing that you're not perfect yet, or that you haven't had success yet, because if you then with the next thing improve yourself, oh my God, you definitely have something to show for. It's a learning process, and art will never reach perfection anyway. It's impossible, and it shouldn't. So that tiny little, the little bit of the American loudness, maybe not loudness, but the little bit of the American confidence, I suppose, if we could inject that into ourselves over here, I think that might do us the world of good. To get that show-off gene activated.
Yeah, and I think as well as that there is also the idea of showing or presenting yourself as authentically or as openly as you feel comfortable to the world. And I think that's something that seems very important to you as well, that you do talk a lot about your upbringing and the things that brought you to Ireland, and your life up to this point has been quite unique, let's say.
I wonder so if you unique. Could
bring me through some
Ooh,
of...
I am very loud. I am so incredibly loud about my past, my history. I was brought up... I will dive straight into it, because... And then I will explain why. Then I will explain why I'm so loud about these things. And why I will never shy away from talking about them. So I was brought up in a mountain tribe in the Himalayas. We were goat herders. I was born in a house that was made of clay. Didn't have electricity. We didn't have running water. So it was quite a different world that I was born into. I was born into a tribe that lived, you know, off the grid, and we had tribal customs. We had, you know, my grandmother has a big tattoo on her chin. So it's like it's very deep down tribal roots. And then I was brought to Austria. My mother brought me to Austria, and then I grew up for the next kind of 13 years in Austria. I have a very traumatic past. Now, I don't want to trigger anybody, but there was a lot of violence perpetrated upon me. Let's put it that way, because we don't want to trigger anybody here. And then I went into prostitution when I was 16. And then I kind of liberated myself from that when I was 20. Then I met a charming Irishman. Those green eyes, they just captured me, and I was gone. And then so I came to Ireland 11 years ago now, because I fell in love with an Irishman. And he was charming, and it was nice, and it was all great. And then I had children. I had my children quite young. I had my children at 23 and 27, 26. But that relationship deteriorated, and then there was some, you know, domestic violence. Let's put it that way. And then in the winter of 2020, I had to go. So I took my kids, and I lived in a women's refuge for a while, Saoirse Women's Refuge, who are an amazing organization, and I will forever sing their praises. So they can be found, and they are discreet, and they are wonderful. And if anybody ever needs anything, that's the place to go. Women's Aid and Saoirse Women's Refuge. But of course, that was that was 2020, so like, you know, that was a whole, do you remember 2020? That was, there was something, wasn't there? There was a thing happening.
We all fell asleep for 12 months, yeah. And
we were all, remember there was a thing that happened. So obviously then, you know, living in a refuge in the middle of lockdown, was tremendously difficult. But you know, we got out, we found a house, and I thought that was the end of it. I swear to God, I thought I had all the adventures, and then more things happened. So currently I'm sitting here in Luke's beautiful cottage. I'm homeless again. but the point, and here now is the point, why I'm always, and I, as you mentioned, Luke, I'm really loud about it, and I never shy away from openly saying that, you know, I used to be a prostitute. It's a thing that I did. I had been, you know, severely abused by my parents. It's a thing that happened. So the reason I say these things is because there have been situations in which people have reached out to me for help because they knew kind of a little bit that I had gone through something, and could I help them? Could I point them where to go? Did I have the phone number for a refuge? And I was like, I can drive you there, honey, because I know where it is, because I've lived there. So I understand that it is very much my responsibility, because I have the wherewithal and the knowledge and the strength, I suppose, even though I hate that word, to be able to carry the questions. And the questions are hugely important, because we should speak about these things openly, because they are so often hidden away and we don't talk about them until it's too late, until some terrible tragedy has happened. And then we might mention them, but they never get spoken about with authentic voices. And I'm very privileged, I'm extremely privileged to have survived all the things that I survived, and now to be able to have a voice and to speak about them. And that's our point as artists. That's what we should be doing. That is the very core of what art is. It's telling stories that are uncomfortable. And mine very much is, but it's my responsibility. It's not so much that I talk about it for the sake of, God forbid, like showing off or whatever. It's my responsibility, because I know there's people who might not have that strength or the words. So that's why I'm so loud about it.
The word that comes to mind there is bravery in telling a story, but I imagine that's probably a...
Yeah. Yes, words like brave or strong or resilient. Resilient is a particular favorite of mine. What people now, and we're kind of going away from film chat here, but I think it's an important point to make, because it's an important point to make. Trauma and the survival thereof. I mean, you particularly, you've seen me at my very worst. It's not a linear thing, and it comes in fits and starts. And the imagery that I present to the world of this very strong, very brave, very resilient person, and I make jokes about it. Oh, the jokes I make about all of these things, which I can't make those jokes because I've been there. They portray an image of a survivor, of somebody who's very, very strong, very, very brave. But as you very well know, I think you are one of the people who knows that best. There's darkness. Oh, there's so much darkness. There is such a deep abyss. But And here we're coming back to the important bits. But in that deep abyss, we can find so much gold nuggets that we can drag to the surface and that we can shine a light on and that we can explore and that we can discover and that we can turn into something that's really actually quite important. And I think the best pieces and the best stories come from that very, very deep place. Now, that's not to say in order to be an artist, you have to have trauma, which I hate that trope. You know, I hate the trope of the starving artist. I hate the trope of the artist who suffers trauma and therefore they can't, you know, you can't make art if you have a happy childhood and a good home. Yes, of course you can. It's probably very, very whole. It's beautiful art and you can still understand the depths of the human condition. But that depth and that abyss does allow for us to explore sides to our psyche that we may not otherwise have been able to reach out to. And I think that's where the responsibility comes in of dealing with the darkness. And it seeps into my work. It seeps into my work a lot. Even when I don't need it to or want it to, it's always there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose art also is, in a way, like I'm thinking of, let's say, the Greek tragedies or such. There's often a thing that art is supposed to give us examples of maybe more extreme versions of things that may happen in real life. And then by getting to experience these things vicariously, we get to develop empathy for the the characters, the story that's taking place, while also having a bit of a safe distance in knowing that it's not something that's happening to us personally as an audience. So yeah. That seems to be a major sort of social function that art can
absolutely
have.
And that's what storytelling has always been about. That is, and I you know, I'm so passionate about the performing arts because it is, along with visual arts, it's the oldest art form, you know. The first time we did this, we had the performing arts before we were even human. You know, before humanity existed, there existed a fireplace around which somebody stood up and told a story. You know, in the most primitive language there was, but it was a story, and they performed the story for us to give us insight, to give us knowledge, to teach the next generation to explore a side of themselves that eventually led to them becoming humanity. So it's a very proud and old tradition that we are blessed to be a part of. Film is a continuation of the performing arts in that very real sense. Yes, of course, now we have all the technical aspects that come into it and all of the really interesting new ways in which we can tell that story. But at the core of it, it's people sitting around a light that gives them a story. And we have not lost that. And I don't think we will ever lose that as long as we're, you know, even resembling something human. So there's a huge responsibility there. And I'm very proud to be a part of that old ancient tradition.
Yeah, it's a very important thing. So to bring it sort of back down to the nuts and bolts a bit, I know you're very prolific in your writing. You've written a huge amount of scripts, and I wonder, could you talk a bit about that?
Mm-hmm. So my writing process is quite straightforward. When I have an idea, I will write down a log line, I'll write down a title, and the title is always... The only film I've ever actually been happy with a title with is The Closing. And that's a really good title and I'm really proud of it and nobody can steal it now because it's there. But normally I really hate the titles I come up with because they're awful. And then I'll write down a log line and then I'll just jot down... It's never more than one page. I refuse to do more than one page on any idea. So I jot down the idea, do a one-page kind of... synopsis, or not even a synopsis, the vibe of the thing. And then I'm like, this is something. We're going to sit down and write this now. Or I'm like, that wasn't so good, was it? I don't know how many of these like one pagers I have like floating around. God bless them. They must be in their, you know, hundreds. I don't know. Because most of them are really shit. Like most of them are just not worth the paper they were written on. But if it's a good thing, if it's so let's take the closing for example. It was really good. I really liked it. I was like, I was sitting in my car. I was picking up my kids from school and I wrote it down. I was like, oh, that's a good one. There we have a live one here, children. And I brought my kids home and I did all the parenting thing. And then that night I sat down. I was like, yes, no, the closing is a story I will tell, and I'll tell it right now. And the next day at around noon, the first draft of the feature was written. I'd say about 70 pages written. So I write quite quickly. I find, especially with screenwriting, the best analogy I can always give is imagine watching a film scene by scene. You'd never. It would either drive you insane or you would give up on the thing. So writing the first draft in one go, or in as few goes as you could possibly manage, helps the flow. It helps the pacing. It helps you understand the story. It helps you understand everything. So from inception to the first draft of the feature being completed, it was about, now inception probably, because I had the idea for it on the Saturday. And that was a Monday that I wrote down the log line, and that was a Tuesday when I'm done. So yeah, let's say 72 hours from inception to completion for the first draft. Because it was a spark that was right there, because I needed to get it, because if it's a story that doesn't keep you up at night wanting to write it, it's not going to be a story that keeps other people up at night wanting to watch it. So that's the reason I write fast, is because if I stop, I lose the momentum, I lose the magic, and I lose interest, really. I'm not a particularly, you know, I'm very lazy. I am very lazy. I don't enjoy having to do a lot of work. So to me, writing quickly and then just be done with it is very important. And with that first draft, I already went. Now also that's not something you should do, really, because you should be sitting through 20 drafts, or well, not 20, but you should be sitting through a good few drafts before you're confident. But most of the time with the first draft or an early draft, I go into a table read, I find some actors, and I workshop, as I'm sure many listeners will know, and I'm sure many of the people listening right now have suffered through my various table reads. God bless you all. I love you all. Because I've done that so much. But it's so important for me to hear the voices. It's so important for me to hear the words that I just wrote down. Because I always say, if the words don't taste good, they're not good. Especially in the performing arts. A novel, you can get away with it not tasting good. But a script, it has to taste good, and the words have to be sayable, which, if a certain person is listening there, I know exactly what he's thinking, where he's like, but they're not sayable, Ronica, and I'm like, yeah. there's a certain person who hates my monologues, so that's my method, is I write very, very quickly, and then I go into a table read very, very quickly. And then I go into the deep work. Then I go into the really, really deep rewrites, where it's like, oh no, there's a lot in this character that we need to find. There's a lot in this story that we need to find. The structure of it needs to change. And then those are then like, when you come into draft 4 and 5 and 6, that's when you really start to understand the depths that the story can go to. But sometimes, as it is, with, I think with the closing, I'm on draft 6 now. And that's it. That's a shooting script now. So that's that done. That could not exist without, I have to name drop him here now, without Shane, who plays the lead in the closing, who was incidentally also the man who hates my monologues, because I make him say it. But collaborating with other people on your work, you don't have to avoid that as a writer. It will only elevate your work, letting other people in at the early script stages. I know, you and I have talked about this before, and I talk about this a lot. I know writers can be very precious about their words and about what they've written down, and, you know, somebody out to steal my script and stuff like that. And no, nobody's out to steal your script, please, for the love of God. And secondly, if it's... The resulting film is never going to be your voice. It's going to be a culmination of many, many, many voices. It's going to be the director's voice. If you're directing it yourself, it's going to be your voice and the DP's voice, the actor's voices, the production designer's voice, the producer's voice, definitely. So there's a lot that will go into your finished product. And yes, I just called a film a product. Blasphemy, but it is. You don't have control over. And you shouldn't have control over. If you want complete control, you write a novel and then you self-publish it. But filmmaking, not an exercise in complete control. Filmmaking is an exercise in collaboration. And as writers, we have to get that into our heads. Because I think a lot of us, and I was the same at the start of my career, I was like, no, but they change a line, then it's not what I intended with my words. And I'm like, as soon as I come into a room with an actor, I'm like, so what I wrote down here you can forget about and we'll just go find the emotions. And so yeah, my poor actors never actually I give them freedom to find their own lines. Yeah, there's the method.
There's a lot of sort of pragmatism, I feel like, to that as well. So then what would the process then be? So, well, first off, how many of these scripts would you do, let's say, in a year? But then beyond that, let's say you write one and you feel after the table read, you feel like there's something really there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you run through the drafts. What's the process then? Because I feel like that's something that sometimes people might get caught on. They're like, well, I've written a script, do I just cold email production companies? Okay. Or what's the how do you go about that kind
of
thing?
So how do we get it from page to screen? It's changed a lot in the kind of last few years. It's changed a lot as my career has developed. So I would have started out, so in 2019 In 2018, I wrote 3 scripts. In 2019, I would have written maybe 7. 2020, I wrote... In 2020, I wrote 10. 2021 is such a non-year, isn't it? I don't even remember anything I did. But not a lot. Maybe 5.
Only 5 feature scripts.
Only 5 features, yeah. And in 2022, I wrote 1. I wrote the closing. So I think the first 20 scripts I've written, apart from The Indian Wife, because obviously, you know, it's the one that's got the Oscar thing. So I'm like, I can't dismiss that. I can't dismiss it. Because, you know, it's done so much for me. It'll never be made. Like, that film will never be made. But it's a good story that needed to be told. And now, you know, I've got a letter from the Oscars on my wall. So if I had a wall, I'm homeless. I don't have a wall. Those 20 scripts, practice. that's just practice. I needed to learn the craft. I needed to understand what makes a good script good. I needed to learn how to write well. I needed to understand screenwriting. I needed to really, really understand screenwriting, what it is that my voice is. And then I started writing less, and the things that I wrote, I wrote It Was You in 2021. Jesus Christ, that was very important. So then I started writing things that, and It Was You was probably the first script that I felt this way about. Then I started writing things that weren't just stories for the sake of telling stories. It was, I'm writing a script with view to production. And there was a huge difference. So up until that point, it would have been, oh, you know, if this gets made one day, it'd be cool. To, oh, this is getting made. This is getting made. There is no way this is not getting made. It has to be. So that kind of change in attitude happened for me at around, you know, number 2021. When I wrote It Was You, and that was the first script that was like, oh damn, this is a thing that needs to be done. So then the method for there's two categories of scripts. There's the burner scripts where you're like, oh yeah, look, this is my portfolio, and pick and choose, and whatever you like, you can take. And then there's these really, really important films like It Was You, like The Closing, like the short that I'm doing in the UK in April. These are important pieces of work that I need to see through to production. So what I do with those, I think, is more important. With those, let's look at The Closing, because that's the furthest along. I was approached through Stage 32 by a producer in LA. And he was like, I like your vibe. How are you? Let's have a chat. And I was like, yeah, chat. I'm always up for a chat. So I met with this man in LA, and we just kind of sussed each other out and vibed with each other. And we're like, okay, so these are the kinds of films you're making. These are the kinds of films I'd like to make. And he was like, yeah, do you know what? We are actually looking for some more international productions. Do you know of anybody doing anything? And I'm like, I got several things that I have several that we pick and choose. What do you want? Like, just give me what you want, and I can either write it for you, or I probably already have it, which is hugely important for a writer to have that back catalog of work that's just ready. So the question, what else you got, should always be met with anything you want. So you just kind of gave me a breakdown of, oh yeah, we have, you know, this would be the budget range. This would be the themes that we'd like to look at. So I sent him five projects. I sent him Paperweight. I sent him It Was You, of course. I sent him The House with the Blue Windows. I sent him The Closing, and I sent him something else that I can't even remember now, but it was five. And he just kind of picked The Closing, and he was like, oh, this is the interesting one. Let's make that one. So I realized I glossed over the actually really important part here, but how this person got in touch with me, and I think the important part is that they got in touch with me, was because I am relentlessly noisy. Because I've been on podcasts in the States, I've been featured on Instagram live interviews with Stage 32. I've been on podcasts in the UK. I have been, you know, there's blog articles by me floating around. There's, I wrote a goddamn book, which is available on Amazon, by the way. Let's just plug in there.
I love you, Dave Taylor.
Dave Taylor is also a thing, but I also wrote a book about screenwriting. Which is called The Hustle, and it's available on Amazon. we just hustling here. I Love You, Dave Taylor is also available on Amazon. And my new book is coming out in April. But This exactly. This, what I just did, I did. And I did that relentlessly, and I did that in a very annoying, very noisy way. And I caught the attention of people. Because you cannot catch the attention of people if you don't ever speak out. So I did that. And then I tend to find the best relationships and the most interesting results come not from me chasing them. They come from them coming to me. And there's a huge, if you're chasing somebody, then you're not in the position of power. Producers are looking for you. They want to find you. They are begging to find the next thing that they can throw their weight behind. And the added bonus, again, to just really drive it home how lucky we are here in Ireland, we can make a film quite cheaply. If I approach a producer in LA, I said to my producer in LA, yeah, I can make you a film for 120. Yeah, should be possible. It's tight, but it's possible. I know a friend, Baz Black, made his for, 15,000. I don't even know, but I know it wasn't a lot. My first feature that I was involved with, that Jason Ford produced and directed, we made with practically nothing. So, we're so lucky here in the Irish independent film industry here that we're quite plucky. We can make a film quite cheaply, which to somebody in LA, 120,000 is nothing. I find it's more successful when they come to you. But in order for them to come to you, you have to establish yourself, and you have to be noisy, and you have to have a reputation, and you have to have a back catalogue, because that same conversation could have happened and I could have said, yeah, well, I have one script and I've been working on it and it's in draft 75. And that's my one story that I have. And that conversation wouldn't have gone anywhere. It just wouldn't have. So it is that those 3 years of writing a stupid amount of scripts, that most of them are probably not good, just gave me the back catalogue and the confidence that comes from it to say, I can write you anything, because I have written a psychological thriller that's set in Guatemala. I have written a fantasy romance that's set in India. I have written a refugee drama that's set in Australia. I can write you anything you want except horror. I can't because I'm too scared. But anything other than that, I can write you. That you can extrapolate onto other professions. As a DP, yes, I can shoot. I can shoot a gritty drama. Yes, I can stylize things, but yes, I can be very neutral and very documentary style in my filmmaking, in my approach. Same with music, the same with any aspect of filmmaking. The flexibility and the professionalism, I think, that's what's going to get you those conversations. It's not going to be reaching out or cold calling people. Sometimes it will, but it tends to not work. It's letting people come to you because you have a reputation.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. And then I suppose also a lot of that there is also just being part of the community, because I imagine also then lots of people contact you either offering or looking for different things. And, it's when you can be part of the community and be seen and viewed as sort of a valued member, then things do sort of come back or pay back in different ways. Yeah. And I imagine that's a major part, especially when you're dealing with very low budget filmmaking, where we actually had Baz Black on the podcast a few weeks ago, and there's a lot of where people might do a project for a project or that kind of thing. How do you navigate all those things? Because in a way you end up having to ask quite a lot of a lot of people to get projects done. And have you any thoughts on that kind of thing?
I've been, everybody has done so much for me. I can never repay any of the debts that people, you know, that I owe. People have done so much to help me. I would not be here without all the people who have helped me get here. And I am forever indebted to the people I've worked with in the past. I don't know how I can repay it. I hope someday I will be able to. But it is exactly that. I find, no, there's a big difference. There's a huge big difference working internationally and working domestically. Internationally, first of all, it's less favor based and more professional, or a professional approach to, oh yeah, you do this service for me, I will pay you. So for example, on uncredited rewrites or whatever, they'd approach me and they're like, we can pay you for this rewrite. And that's it. That's the extent of the relationship. And I'm like, yeah, there it is. There you go. Delivered. Domestically and in the smaller projects, it is very much a give and take kind of approach. It's very much a, you know, from a producer's point of view, especially, it's very much a, I'd be really great if you could help me out here, and then whatever else you need, I can do for you. But even in the same vein, so say the project I'm doing in London in April, that's just a little, it's not a little short, but it's a short, you know, it's a short, and the way I'd be used to making a short film over here would be, oh yeah, we'll get together and we'll make a short film and it'll be good and it'll be important and it'll be the best we can make it. In London, it's like, oh no, we're in this to make money. Like this is a product. This is a product we hope to sell. There's a point and purpose to every single thing that we do. So the attitude shifts, I think, when you start working internationally. And I love both attitudes. I'm not saying that our attitude of community and of getting together and getting something off the ground, I love that. I think that's so special and it's so powerful and it's beautiful. But I find, or the limited experience I have, that's not how it works in other industries. So it's a really interesting approach. But yeah, like I said, the favors people have done for me, oh my God, I can never, like, unpayable debt.
Sure, yeah, because we, you know, it is part of there's a lot of experience to be gained in the time on set, and oftentimes that can be, like, I kind of often would think of film as being more of a craft than an art a lot of the time. It's something where the learning is done on the job, and a lot of the time that means working on lower paid or unpaid projects, and some of that learning can be really, really valuable.
Yeah.
But then I suppose there is a balance then when, you know, whenever, let's say, someone that's agreed to be around for a weekend then gets booked for a paid job, then they're gone. They're so gone. I guess there's that's one of the sort of considerations that comes in with a project where you're not able to sort of cover people's you know,
exactly,
rates and such.
There's this duality between I'll do this for the love of it, but I also have to eat. And I wish I would never have to get people to do things unpaid. I wish I had, you know, the money and the resources. But you know, we'll get there. We'll get there. We'll get to a point where I never have to ask any favors and just be like, here's your paycheck. But especially at the start of your career, exactly like you said, it's a learning experience that we all have to go through. But you need to find a way, you need to find a path, especially if you want this to be your job. And this is more for this is more for crew and talent rather than I think directors, because directors are always going to have that ownership of the entire project. And you know, it's a different approach. I think I find that for myself. But if you're sound up, or if you're talent that who comes in for like a day, and you're not the lead, maybe that attitude, yeah, but I'm providing a service here, I ought to get paid. And most people have that. Most people have that, and I think it's a very healthy attitude to take. Because it's a profession at the end of the day. And at the start of your career, you might be shy to ask for money, or shy to ask for a contract, or shy to ask for, sure, but it's only, like, we're only just shooting a little thing here. No. This is my time, this is my money, this is my expertise and my craft that it took me a long time to acquire. I should be compensated. Whether it's, you know, cash in hand on the day, or whether it's something at the back end. But yeah, I want a contract, and I want to be compensated. And that's important, just for your own sake, just for your own sanity. Because at the end of the day, this is our dream job. Like, let's face it. I've worked at Microsoft. I've worked at Google. I've worked corporate jobs. And this is my dream job. But it's a job. It's a job. It is a job. And I deserve to be paid for the work that I do. But yeah, at the start of my career, I definitely owe the favors I had to ask. I owe so much. If you want to call in your favors, anybody who's listening, and I owe them a favor, which I'm sure is everybody who's listening, call them in. I'm fine. I can do whatever I want. I can do things.
Leave a comment on the Facebook post.
Exactly.
It's an interesting world we're in. So then now, like, looking sort of towards the future then, so I know, so mm-hmm. the closing is going to be your big project for this year. And mm-hmm. I feel like I do get a lot of sort of a sense of ambition, I guess, mm-hmm. from you, which I feel like is a very important thing, and having the vision and stuff.
Yeah.
And how would you be able to talk a bit about that and what might be coming up?
So the future looks quite bright, hopefully. It should. Jesus Christ, the past is bleak enough. And we have the tragic backstory. Let's now have the meteoric rise, please. So yeah, so the closing is eating up all my attention at the moment. Along with Acura, I'm actually really proud of where Acura is going. Acura is such a fantastic community of writers. Everybody we signed is absolutely amazing, and the projects that they have on the go, all of our writers have on the go, like, that's just, I mean, there's a few real stingers in there. So Acura and The Closing and my two shorts, so Wicklow Stories and Prig, which is, I just revealed the title. There you go, title reveal, which is the short I'm doing in the UK. Those are my big things for this year. So 2023 is pretty full. 2023 is pretty full. Because technically The Closing was supposed to release, but I don't think, we'll see, I'm not going to comment on that. Thereafter, my next big project is It Was You, which is my big passion project, which is it's the love of my life, that project, in a different way from The Closing, because The Closing is a very, I love the story of The Closing, but It Was You is also very close to my heart. So that's my feature for 2024. I'm in talks there. I don't know how far along those talks are, but the talks exist. And then, so that's for 2024, and then in 2025 we're going to attempt something absolutely hilarious and wonderful that I can't talk about at all, but I'm so excited for that one. Like, this is the best thing ever. It's hilarious. It's completely not my style, because it's a comedy, which is wild. and wacky, and it's got pineapples. That's all I can say. So yeah, the closing for 2023, it was you for 2024, and pineapple madness for 2025. And to look beyond would be crazy. But yeah,
fair enough. Well, yeah, I suppose before we kind of wrap things up, is there anything, well, I guess actually, would there be any advice you might give to the Ronica of 5 years ago in 2018 when it comes to the professional work and the filmmaking journey you've been on? Anything that you think you would
don't be afraid to ruffle feathers, because sometimes we really do have to. And other than that, oh no, she did all right. Patience, because I bet 2018 Ronica was like, it took you 5 years, what, that's way too long. Yeah, from the first time sitting down to write a screenplay to now being, you know, blessed enough to be able to direct my first feature, 5 years is not a long time. But to her it would be, she'd be like, Jesus Christ, that's half a decade, how dare you take so long, should be done in 6 months, Veronica, come on. It takes a long time. It's film, it takes a long time to get where you want to go. But that urgency should be there. You should think that it only should take you 6 months, because then you're working with it. But okay, now come on, it's already been 4 months. That's because we have a deadline of 2 months now. We have to get this going. So that attitude of urgency is a good thing. Let's pretend it only takes 6 months, because then we work as if it only takes 6 months. So that would be my advice: urgency and professionalism and drive.
Very good. Ronica, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Really looking forward to seeing the closing when it comes out, and your writing as it comes out over the next while as well.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. It was really enjoyable.